If slavery is such a bad thing, why does the Bible seem to approve of it? Do you want to understand the Bible, but you're confused? You've come to the right place. This is Tough Bible Questions on Timothy Talks, where I'm going to work through answers to your questions about the tough, challenging, and sometimes flat-out weird sections of the Bible. Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Timothy Talks. I'm Daniel Pentamone, your host for today's show, and I'm eager to get into another one of these tough Bible questions. Does the Bible condone slavery? Now, before I delve into this question, I do have to warn you, this is a huge topic. There are so many different biblical passages that deal with this. So what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to give you a sort of top-level survey of the question, but honestly, there's just no way that I can get into all the weeds. So you may have heard or read some biblical text, and you may be really concerned about it, or you may want some answers about it. If I don't get to your biblical text, I'm sorry, I just don't have enough time to answer all of the specific passages that are out there. There just isn't the time. But my first point before we actually delve into this is that biblical morality is an in-house discussion for theists. Meaning, in other words, if you are listening to this show and you are a person of faith, of any kind of faith, you can ask this question, why does the Bible condone slavery? You can even ask this question if you want to understand the Christian faith. Maybe you're an atheist, maybe you're an agnostic, and you feel that the Christian faith contradicts itself. You can still ask this question. But if you're an atheist or an unbeliever who is against slavery and you just believe that the Bible is wrong, that the Bible is evil because you don't agree with the sort of morality that is included in the Bible, well, you don't really have the right to answer that opinion. I mean, I'll just be honest with you. You don't have a leg to stand on. You don't even believe that there is right or wrong. Or if you're not a person of faith, you can't make moral judgments. So why in the world do you think that the Bible is wrong or evil when you can't even tell me what is right and wrong and evil? I'm not saying that to be dismissive, but I am just saying as a person who doesn't believe in God, you don't have a lot of an ability to criticize biblical morality when you don't even have a foundation for your own morality. Now, here's the problem. What is the problem? Well, there's actually two problems, and they are separate. In the New Testament, you see that Paul gives instruction to various groups of people about how to live the Christian faith. And when he comes to slaves, he doesn't say, run away. He says, work hard. Work hard for the Lord. And then when he comes to masters, he doesn't say, free your slaves. He says, treat your slaves well. So obviously, this seems to be an implicit endorsement of slavery by the Apostle Paul. And then you have a much bigger problem in the Old Testament. Because in the Old Testament, in the Law of Moses, you see that God institutes a system of living for his chosen people. And he gives very specific laws about slavery and what slavery should be like and how long people are to be slaves and many other rules. And based on that, well, it seems like here's God and he is setting up a system, it appears, of institutional slavery. So how can that possibly be a good thing? Well, obviously, this seems like a problem. And then you have passages like Exodus 21, where you actually read in the Bible about how one Hebrew can own another Hebrew. Then you even have stipulations in the Old Testament of what it should look like, what slavery should look like when a man sells his daughter as a slave to another man. Now, for modern ears, obviously, this is highly, highly disconcerting, very troubling. We can't imagine anything like that. So what in the world do we do with a Bible that has issues like this in it? Now, by the way, before I even provide an answer for that, I feel sometimes like when I introduce these tough Bible questions, like I'm just digging a ditch for myself. And the more I go into these tough Bible questions, it's like the ditch just gets deeper and deeper. And I'm just digging it deeper, and I'm bringing up all of these things because sometimes we try to sanitize the Bible. But, you know, let's just be honest. I mean, these are questions, and if we're going to have a faith that's based on the Bible, we need to answer questions like this, tough Bible questions. Because honestly, yes, the ditch is deep, but in a sense, if you're a Christian, I mean, you are here in the ditch with me, and we need to have some solid answers, or else why are we placing so much trust in the Bible? We do need solid answers for our faith. Well, I'm going to delve into these questions, and specifically this question of slavery, in just a minute. I'll be right back. Just take a quick listen to this. Now it's your turn. This season at Timothy Talks, the goal is to answer your tough Bible questions. So, do you have a tough Bible question? If so, email it to timothytalkspodcast@gmail.com. That's timothytalkspodcast@gmail.com. Plus, every time you send a tough Bible question, you'll get a chance to win a Bible study resource of your choice so that you can understand the Bible even better. We might devote a whole podcast episode to answering your tough Bible question. So, I'm back. Talking about slavery, like I said, this is a huge issue. It's also complicated by the fact that we're dealing with two different testaments, the Old Testament and the New Testament. And then, to make it even more complicated, we're talking about slavery in the land of Israel and also in the Roman Empire, which these are very different forms of slavery than in the present world. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a few principles to help you navigate through this question. Like I said, there isn't time to navigate through every question on slavery. And atheists, they love to take these passages on slavery and use them to talk about how bad the Bible is. Honestly, if you just look straight at some of these passages, they do look bad, but the principles that I'll give, hopefully they'll help you to answer some of these questions. And even though there isn't time to answer every law, look at every situation, what you'll find is that when you do that, if you can get some resources to do that, you'll find that most all of these difficulties go away. And I would say all of the difficulties do go away if you're willing to recognize what's going on and you're willing to recognize the time in history and what God is doing. So let's start with some principles, though, primarily about Old Testament slavery. What is slavery like in the Old Testament? And the first principle is this. Ancient slavery is very different from modern slavery. This is really basic. You've got to understand this. Ancient culture in the Near East indicated that slavery was just such a different institution. Now, today, we assume that slavery is sort of the worst thing that can happen. For you to actually own a slave, that's the worst thing that can happen to that person is for them to be owned by another. In the ancient world, in the time of the Old Testament, that was not necessarily the case. So as an example, I'll give you the story of Hagar in the book of Genesis. Hagar is Abraham's concubine. And as a concubine, she's also the servant of Sarah. She's the slave, you could say, of Sarah. We assume, well, that's terrible, and wouldn't Hagar want to be set free? Well, through a series of events, Hagar does become set free. Abraham says, "You're free from slavery," and he kicks her out of the family household, and she's left on her own with her son. And it actually turns out to be about the worst thing that could possibly happen to Hagar. She wanders around in the desert, and she comes to the very brink of her son, at least comes to the very brink of death. She, we assume, not too far behind him. But it's the worst thing that can happen. In fact, the only reason that she doesn't die is because an angelic messenger comes to her, and through a miracle, her son is saved, and they're able to survive. But the point is that we assume that slavery is sort of like the worst thing that can happen for you. Obviously, in the Old Testament times, it was much better for Hagar to be the servant of Sarah than for her to be given her independence like she is. Today, we have fixed governments. Back then, society was very different. There's tribes, and there's ethnicities, and they are in constant combat. There are city-states. We don't really have the idea of a city-state anymore, beside a couple city-states in the modern world, and they're not really the same, but Singapore, in the past, Hong Kong was somewhat like this. It still, to some extent, is. But besides that, we don't really have that. So the whole political landscape is very different, and to be an individual person who is not a slave, if you're just freed from your slavery, that could be a very dangerous thing in the political climate that exists. Basically, there's two ways to become a slave in ancient Israel. The first one is you can be captured in war, and there were certainly many times that Israel was at war, but there were also plenty of times that it wasn't, so you can't view that as the constant way that slaves come into existence. Instead, probably the primary way that you become a slave in ancient Israel is through debt slavery. You are owing money to someone, and you're not able to pay it off, and you can sell yourself into slavery, or you can be sold into slavery until you pay this debt off. So it's not an involuntary constant for the rest of your life. This is until the debt is paid off. So if it's just a small debt, you may be able to work for a year or two, your debt is paid off, and then you're free. Let me just put this out there. One author wrote this. He said, if the idea of debt servitude strikes us as primitive, we need to remember that many of the options that are available to us today were not available in the ancient world for better or for worse. And how preferable is the modern situation, where the poor grow ever poorer as debt grows and grows until the only option for the poor becomes bankruptcy, which not only destroys the debtor's access to credit, but also amounts to breaking one's oath at best and thievery at worst. This system in ancient Israel was intended to maintain incentives to lend to the poor, where interest is not an option and where the risk of default were often quite high. These are the kinds of situations addressed by Old Testament law in a society that differed greatly from our own. It isn't a matter of whether these options would be good for us living in 21st century America, but whether or not these were good for the ancient Israelites living from 1200 to 586 BC. So you can see here, now we may prefer our system that does not include debt servitude, but you can certainly see, though, that our current system where people just keep getting more and more in debt until they become bankrupt and then they have this stain on their names for the rest of their lives, you can certainly understand that while we may look at that as better, there are some disadvantages. The Hebrew system, you work, you go into debt, you work it off, and then you're good. And you've still kept all of your agreements, you've still kept your word, the debts were paid, and you can continue to be viewed as a person who has kept their word. But even the word slave is somewhat deceptive because we use, and I say deceptive, I mean, it brings to mind images that did not come to mind in the times of the Bible. It's not at all what you think of today. Today we think of slavery as the institution that was formed around the 1600s, where slavers would kidnap people from the coast of Africa or buy people who had been kidnapped in the interior of Africa, take them across the ocean, and sell them into slavery. That's really not what's going on. In fact, kidnapping people for any reason, including to sell them into slavery, was a capital offense in the Old Testament. If you did that, you would die because it was viewed as that terrible of a thing. So it's a very different system than we've got. And then we have passages like Exodus 21 verses 5 and 6, where you actually have a situation where a slave actually wants to stay with his master. Again, this is something that boggles our minds as 21st century individuals. We can't imagine, why would a slave ever not want to be freed? But evidently, this did happen in the ancient world. So in Exodus 21, there is a sort of ceremony by which a slave would be given a hole in his ear. He would have his ear bored through. And this was a ceremony that would happen if the slave was so committed to the master that even when they are offered their freedom, they decline it. They don't want it. And so this ceremony occurs with this physical mark in the ear so that people will look at the slave and not feel that the master is abusing the slave when they continue to be slave year after year after year. And actually, this slave is doing this by choice. So this is a voluntary slavery that's going on. So that's the first principle. Ancient slavery is very different from modern slavery. Now, a second principle that's also important is that Old Testament slavery was a merciful institution. Now, again, we've already hit on this somewhat, and let me explain. I'm not saying that by modern standards, slavery was a merciful institution. Obviously, as moderns, we would say, well, there's nothing merciful about that at all. And I get where you're saying. But we have to understand, for how did it strike the people who heard about it in their time? For those people, it would have been considered very merciful in comparison to the world around them. So, for example, slaves are guaranteed certain rights. Now, if you were a Hebrew slave, you were guaranteed the right that at a certain point in time, at specified points in time, you would be given your freedom. This didn't apply to foreigners, but it did apply to Hebrew slaves. Another right that you had, the right of Sabbath rest. So on the Sabbath, you did not have to work for your master. This was free time. This was time off work. Everyone got this, Hebrew or non-Hebrew. Everyone was given this right. So you don't view this just as slaves are property. No, you do have certain rights. We also read that everyone, even the foreign slaves, they're all to be treated with respect and kindness. You see this in Leviticus chapter 19, verses 33 to 34. Here Moses says, "When a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you, and you shall love him as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. Now, first you read that and you think, well, isn't that just about people who are living in the land? Does that really include slaves? And I would say, well, actually, yes, it does, because he draws it back to the Israelites' own experience in Egypt. He says, you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Okay, well, what were the Israelites when they were in Egypt? Well, they were slaves. They were the slaves of the Pharaoh. He says, you were strangers in the land of Egypt, and therefore you need to treat the strangers who are with you. You need to treat them well. You shall not do him wrong. So this would also include the slaves that they have. And we're being told, you have to treat your slaves with kindness. You shall not do him wrong. Now, the individual laws, some of them seem crazy. Some of them might even seem harsh or repressive. Again, though, we have to look at this from the standpoint of the people who received these laws. And actually, we'll find it's not so oppressive as it appears. These are situations that are way better than other nations. Again, I understand they're not the same as ours, but let's try to understand them. Let's take a couple. Exodus 21, verses 7 through 11. This is that passage that I referred to earlier where I said it stipulates what happens when a man sells his daughter into slavery. It says, when a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master, who has designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has broken faith with her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her as with a daughter. If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights. And if he does not do these three things for her, she shall go out for nothing, without payment of money. So here's something that really seems terrible to us. Sell your daughter as a slave to another man? It really sounds horrible. Now, you have to understand that this is happening in a culture in which there is arranged marriages, and oftentimes with what's known as a bride price, where there is a payment that's going from the groom to the family. So we're actually combining two ancient practices, slavery and arranged marriage. And here it appears is a poor man who is in debt, and he's setting up with another man, the man that he actually owes this money to. He's setting up an arranged marriage with his daughter, basically saying, in place of that bride price, you marry my daughter and you forgive my debt. Now, of course, this may seem offensive to modern ears, but I want to point out that while you may have an issue with that, your issue with that whole idea is actually with arranged marriages, which is a very separate issue. So try to recognize you may not like this, you may not feel comfortable with it, but maybe your issue is with the arranged marriage as opposed to with the slavery side of it. However, here's what the law says. So she's considered as a slave, but she actually has the rights and she's treated as a wife. First of all, she doesn't get to leave after 7 years. A typical Hebrew slave gets to leave after 7 years. She does not. Because obviously, and this is common sense, because if you marry someone, they don't get to leave after they've been married for 7 years and then say, hey, okay, my slavery is done, my marriage is done, it's been 7 years. No, you're married to this person for life. Second, if the master realizes that he doesn't want to marry her, well, dad gets a chance to redeem her. In other words, he still has to come up with the money. Maybe he thought that his debt was going to be paid off. Well, the guy says, no, I don't really want to marry your daughter, assuming that he's not already married, because assuming that he is, then it's final. It doesn't get to change. But if he says, I don't want to marry your daughter after all, okay, sure, but the man still has to pay the debt that he's owing to this other man. A third thing is he can't sell her to foreign nations. No, this is his wife now, and he can't just sell her to a foreign nation. In other words, she's not of the same sort as just any other slave. And by the way, I would also say, slaves in general, there were protections of not being sold off. Another thing is that if she is for this man's son, so he doesn't buy her for himself, but he buys her for his son, he has to treat her like a daughter. And then the fifth thing is this. If he does decide to marry someone else, he can't make her the second place wife. Okay, so in ancient Israel, you could marry a second person. This is unfortunate. It's not God's plan or design for marriage, but it did happen. It didn't apparently happen very often. Seems like an unlikely thing that was happening, but it did happen. And so if he marries someone else besides this woman that is sort of his slave, if he marries someone else, Well, she can't become the second place wife. She still gets just as much food, clothing, and marital rights as the other woman. So that's one example here. Another passage that could be difficult is Exodus 21, verses 20 through 21. Let me read to you what this passage says. It says, "When a man strikes his slave, male or female, with a rod, and the slave dies under his hand, he shall be avenged. But if the slave survives a day or two, he is not to be avenged, for the slave is his money." Now, this passage has gotten a really bad rap. Some people conclude that what this means is that if you beat your slave to the brink of death, but they survive for 48 hours and 1 minute, hey, everything's fine. It doesn't matter if they die. You did nothing wrong. They survived past the 48-hour mark, so you can do anything to them. Some people assume that that's what this is saying. Well, in order to understand this passage, first of all, let me just mention avenging, because it says he shall be avenged. Nowadays, we have a justice department, and they have the police, and they have the courts, and all of that. In ancient Israel, you didn't have anything like that, okay? So if your family member is killed by someone else, you become the avenger. In other words, the justice is placed on your lap. You are responsible for tracking down the murderer and then killing the murderer yourself. Now, it's certainly many laws that governed this. There were still trials, there were still court cases, although they were not handled in courts as we think of them. There were also provisions to protect people who had accidentally hurt or killed someone else. But that's basically how the law would work, is that you would yourself become the avenger of your relative. So in this case, though, it says that if the slave survives for a day or two, then they don't get to be the avenger. Their family members do not become the avengers. And then we have, though, this weird thing. I mean, like, why is that? Really? 1 to 2 days, and then they don't be avenged? Well, I think we need to understand what this passage is saying in a broader context, because if you actually go down just a couple verses away, you have a very famous dictum of the Mosaic Law. In fact, this phrase itself comes to summarize so much of the Mosaic Law. It says in Exodus 21, verses 23 through 25, "But if there is harm, then you shall pay life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe." And this is, again, said just very close to that other passage about beating your slave. And it's a general principle that applies throughout law. Now, sometimes the Mosaic Law is looked at as a mean, nasty, vengeful thing where, hey, if someone beat you, you can beat them. If they took your eye, you can take their eye. And it shouldn't actually be understood that way. That's actually not the intent of this passage. But the intent of this passage is, though, vengeance can be satisfied to this degree. Now, you can't go beyond. If they take maybe your finger, you can't take their arm, for example. So it's actually limiting the amount of violence that can be done, but it is saying that there is an acceptable amount of violence that can be done. And because it's put within this passage even of slaves, the implication is clear. If you harm your slave physically, you don't just get to say, well, they're my property. No, not at all. You harmed your slave physically, and they have a right, if they wish to pursue this, they have the right also to justice from you. So we understand this isn't saying you can beat your slave. If they survive for 48 hours, then nothing happens. No, on the contrary, if you injure them, you are liable to be injured yourself in this society. And we also see that right after this passage, we see it applied in the case of slaves. So slaves have rights when their eye is harmed or their teeth are harmed, or we can really assume any other bodily injury that a slave goes through. They have rights and they can seek justice. So the point is this. What if you live just 3 days afterward? Well, justice is to be paid because you can't cause someone bodily injury, not even your slave, and not pay the consequences in the Old Testament system. So what exactly would happen to you? Well, there isn't really a rule. If you beat your slave like this, we don't know what would happen. But justice in those days, it wasn't written down in the same way. So the respected men of the city, they would come together, they would hold a council, and they would debate how to properly apply the law of Moses. And then based on that, they would determine the punishment. So they would be looking at passages like this about eye for eye and tooth for tooth. They would hear the complaint, and then the wise and respected men of your village and of your town would come together, and they would figure out just how exactly to promote justice in these cases. Let me move on, though, to a third principle. God sometimes permits what he does not condone. And I'm not going to read the whole passage, but we see this in Matthew chapter 19, verses 3 through 9. The Pharisees come, they say, is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause? And Jesus says, well, actually, you're missing the point. Sure, there is divorce mentioned in the Old Testament, and there's writing this bill of divorcement or this certificate of divorce. But Moses didn't tell you that you should divorce your wife. He simply said, if you do divorce your wife, here's how you should handle it. So, and then Jesus goes on to draw from that principles. He's saying you're missing the point. The point isn't that you have certain rights to divorce your wife. The point is that God, because he knew of the hardness of your heart, in fact, it says that, because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. So I think we also have to take this principle into account. The Old Testament is a time where God is working in the people of Israel, and he is working to bring about the conditions for the Messiah. And those conditions aren't favorable always, but he's working. So I think sometimes even in this situation of slavery, we need to understand that just because slavery is presented in the Bible doesn't mean that that's a complete acceptance of slavery. Sometimes God is working with people where they are. Now, we're going long and there's still so much to get to, so I'm going to try to be quick, but delve also into slavery in the New Testament. Let me just briefly mention what slavery was like in ancient Rome and compare that to America. In ancient Rome, around 50% of the population was enslaved, maybe up to 90% of the population of the city of Rome, and they were treated as property. You could do anything to your servants, any kind of abuse, perfectly permitted, nothing to stop you. In fact, some of the harsh slave laws of ancient Rome make modern slavery, and even slavery in the more recent times, appear almost mild. And I don't say that slavery is mild. I'm not saying that, but I am saying ancient Rome was notorious for how terribly they could treat their slaves. There's an example in Roman history so there was this law. In ancient Rome, if a slave kills his master, everyone is crucified. All of the slaves are crucified because the thinking goes, well, they must have probably had some advanced knowledge of it, or at least if you are a slave, you are responsible to protect your master. And so if the slave dies and is killed by one of the other slaves, you are responsible. So everyone dies. All of the slaves are going to be crucified. So an instance comes up in Roman history where a slave kills his master. And this master actually has a number of slaves, including a number of women and children among his slaves. And so some people go, hold on, wait a second, do we really have to apply the law in this case? I mean, do all these poor, innocent people have to die because the master got killed? There's some debate, there's some deliberation. In the end, they say, yes. And sure enough, they're all crucified. Now, this is horrible. This is about as brutal and horrific and tragic as you can think. But that is what slavery looks like in the ancient world of ancient Rome. This is not to say that all slaves in Rome experienced this sort of horrific things. In fact, many slaves in Rome did quite well. And you could be a teacher, you could be a poet, you could be a doctor, and you could and do so as a slave. That could be your work, and you could be a very successful slave. So I'm not trying to paint all of Roman slavery as the most miserable, but I'm saying it had the potential to be that bad. Paul doesn't encourage slaves to leave, but to serve their masters. Again, because of time, I'm not going to go through all these passages. But what Paul is doing basically is he tells you on gospel issues, you serve Jesus Christ, regardless of the consequences. But in other matters, you accept the life that God has given you and you trust God as raw and as brutal and as dirty as that life may be. Because you recognize that the physical realm is not all there is in this world. There's also the spiritual realm. The spiritual realm is the realm that will exist for eternity. And so he says in Galatians 3:28, there is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free. There is no male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. The point is this, you're a Jew today, or a Greek, or a slave, or a free man, or a male, or a female. I mean, those things are true. Don't try to act as if those things aren't, but in the spiritual dimension, in the eternal dimension, those things are not the defining characteristics. The defining characteristic is your relationship with Jesus Christ. Are you in Christ Jesus? Then we have the letter of Philemon in the Bible. This is perhaps the most delicate, careful, sensitive letter, and maybe even the most beautiful letter that Paul ever writes. He's entreating with a slave owner, Philemon, and it appears that Philemon has a runaway slave named Onesimus. And so he's begging Philemon to take back Onesimus, no longer as a mere slave, but as something more, as a brother in Jesus Christ. Again, not time to deal with all of these things, but I will add that as Christianity became rooted in the Roman world, over a process of several hundred years, slavery in the Roman Empire gradually disappeared. Now, there are many reasons why, certainly not only a religious reason. There were also economic and financial reasons why it left. But one very big reason, certainly something that has to be accounted for, is the spread of Christianity and a change in thinking. Whereas Christianity grew in the culture, so the desire for slaves and the whole idea of slavery became less and less attractive in that culture. I'm sure you have more questions. I wish there was more time to deal with some of these things. In the end, slavery is a situation that was not present in the Garden of Eden. Certainly, one human being owning another human being like a piece of property, that was never part of God's intention for a perfect world. But we don't live in a perfect world. Sometimes God sees fit to permit less than perfect circumstances. And if we object, in the end we have to realize God is God. He has the ability to do what he wants to do. He's sovereign. He made the world and he rules the world. When we learn to study the character of God, even the laws that he sets in place, we constantly see his love, his kindness, his mercy to his creation. So that in the end, even what seems unfair, we can ultimately exclaim that the word of the Lord is upright, as it says in the Psalms. Thank you so much for listening. I'm glad you joined me in this. I know there's more to be discussed, but hopefully at least that's some thinking for you as you think through this question of slavery in the Bible. Next week, I'm going to be talking about a mysterious prophet. And really, this is a prophet that shows up deep in the Bible. He's mysterious. He delivers miracles, and then he gets tricked into sinning and killed by a lion. Really weird, really strange stuff. So please join me and subscribe if you've not done so. And tell your family and friends about this. Maybe they would be interested in this question. Maybe they would be interested in what I'm going to be talking about next week. But please do subscribe, share. Thank you so much for listening, though, and God bless.